Well, good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
And so, a couple of announcements. One is that, just a reminder what I said, I think I said last week, we're going to have a Sangha hike for anybody who wants to go for a hike with us all on April 16th, Easter Sunday. And the details will be announced, but probably it'll be around 10:30 we'll meet. And it will probably be up on Russian Hill, up in top of Skyline, where there's a beautiful view of both the ocean and the bay. And it's relatively flat. It's a little bit up and down. Not much. And people can also choose kind of a little bit how they go. And we don't necessarily all have to walk together, depending if it's too difficult for some people. Or if you have better ideas for a place, you can let me know. But that's what I'm thinking of now. And then the following Saturday, which is April 22nd, we'll have a one-day sitting over at the Unitarian Church. And are there any questions about the questionnaire?
Does everyone have a question?
If you came in late, you probably missed. And the idea behind the questionnaire, I think as it says, is so that I and those of you all who are kind of involved in steering or deciding the future for our Sangha can have some better idea of what would serve you all, what would serve you best, and the kind of choices we have to make and what to offer. So any announcements? Oh, I have another one. That is, on next Monday, Sylvia Borstein is going to come and speak. And Sylvia Borstein is a fantastic woman and teacher. I feel like I almost can't praise her enough. I think she's really a wonderful woman. When I was being trained to be Vipassana teacher, I kind of thought she was like the role model for me. So I'm very glad she's coming down here. So she'll come here next Monday. Other announcements?
The next meeting of the hearing committee will be a week from tomorrow, Tuesday, at Magda's house at 6:30. Did you say 6:30? Mm-hmm. 6:30. And it will be a working, and we'll be bringing our own dinner if we need to, and sitting there and eating.
I ran off some more copies of the flyer about the workshop this Saturday, the relationship as a path to spiritual awakening. I don't know if that was the exact wording, but people did need to sign up in advance if they're interested in going. It's $50, and there's a phone number you can call. Where you check my numbers.
I don't know if there are any left, but I brought some books and pamphlets and a newsletter from the English Sangha. They've been here, a group of monastics have been here for several months, and they're leaving now, and I was up there this weekend, and they didn't want to take everything back, and so they asked me to bring down material here. We had two of them here, Sister Chandasiri and Ajahn Karunika. And if any of you are interested in receiving their books or pamphlets, you can write to them if you got anything, and just send them postage and they'll send it to you, because they're given dana to publish all these things, and so they distribute them freely. And Ajahn Amaro has a book that's in press now, it's coming out soon. And that will be available, I think, within the next 6 months. So if anyone wants to write to Amaravati in England and request anything, they'll be glad to send it to you. They do it all the time.
Greg?
Just wanted to remind people that Wednesday night at 7 o'clock in this room is
the. And also Thursdays we have sittings now, 7 to 8:30. And Stephen gave the talk last Thursday, and Elaine's going to give a talk discussion this Thursday, and then the following Thursday I'll be back. And then after that, I think after I'll give it this Elaine, and then it's myself, and then after that, I think Margaret Mann's going to give a talk. Those of you who know her.
Are those in this room?
Yeah, you're here. They're here. And okay. So. Yes.
Do people need time? Do you want to give them time to finish the questionnaire now?
You need more time? Should we take some couple of minutes of silence to fill out the questionnaire, or?
We can read it. Can't we? Some of the questions look like it would be nice to have some time to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And they're very much appreciated, whatever you say. So it would be nice if you remember to bring them back. Sometimes
there's a box on the Donna basket table for you to leave them in, and the pencils too.
The woman behind you in the white. Yes.
Will the talk next week be at the same time?
Everything's the same, yeah. Okay, so it's perhaps, I think it's a coincidence that the talk tonight could be called, could be titled Questioning, since we have a questionnaire. It wasn't, I think it's a coincidence. But I wanted to start by telling you one of my favorite stories from the Buddhist canon. And it's a story which I like a lot because I misunderstand it. And the story is, soon after the Buddha was enlightened, he was walking down this road, and you can imagine he was just enlightened. So people who are just enlightened tend to be very radiant and shiny and golden and, you know, just kind of very inspiring to see. So he was walking down the road, and he passed this man. He came upon this man. This man noticed the Buddha, who was kind of radiant, and said, what's your story? What's going on with you? And the Buddha said, I am a Buddha, fully awakened. And the man said, may it be so, and kept walking. And that's the story. And the traditional understanding is that that they give sometimes in Southeast Asia is that it was a little bit of pity about this man. He kind of missed his chance. He was the first person to meet the Buddha after the Buddha was enlightened. He missed his chance. And maybe it's very easy to overlook people who have a lot of wonderful qualities and just not see it and just keep walking right on by. And so that's kind of something like that is the usual interpretation. But I have, you know, for me, I had the Zen interpretation, which was, this guy was kind of like a Zen master, and even someone like a Buddha comes up and says, you know, here I am. He says, oh, that's nice. He keeps walking. And so this man who kept walking, he also, I felt, you know, in my interpretation, is also a very special person who didn't have many attachments and was quite free himself, so free that he wasn't even caught by someone else's enlightenment and just could keep walking on. And then there's a contemporary, maybe a contemporary story of this from this weekend. I was up at early Saturday morning, like 7:30 or something, 7 o'clock. I was at the San Francisco Zen Center to use their library. And I have a key to the Zen Center, which opens the back door. So I snuck into the back door of the Zen Center. And it's, the library is in the basement, so I sneak in the back door into the basement and got into the library, because I also have a key for, which is really great. And then I was finished, and I was going to leave, and I was going to sneak out the back door. And one of my friends there, who's the head cook, caught me and said, hi, and said, why don't you come up and have breakfast? And I said, well, I'm in a hurry. I have a lot of errands to do, and some of them have to do for my wife, and I have to get to this meeting we had on Saturday at 10 o'clock and down Palo Alto, and then I have to get home really quickly. And if I do my errands before the meeting, then I have to do my errands after the meeting, and then I'll be home even later. And then my friend said, well, having a breakfast in the dining room now is Aiken Roshi, Robert Aiken, a Zen master, famous Zen master, is Jack Kornfield. is Mahagusananda, who's one of the great monks. He's called the supreme, I think he's called in English, I don't think he likes the title probably, but the supreme patriarch of Cambodian Buddhism. Really outstanding person. Right? And various other luminaries. They said, why don't you come to breakfast? So I thought that would be nice, I thought. And especially I never met Mahagusananda. I really thought it would be really nice to go up and meet Mahagusananda. So I was standing there by the back door. What should I do, you know? And thinking, well, if I go up and have breakfast, some of the errands I won't do, and some they'll be late for my wife, and I have to explain to my wife why I'm late. And my wife's going to say, oh, she, you know, I imagined, she's not going to be impressed by my claim that it's so important to go sit with these wonderful people. You know, so what? So here I was, kind of sitting there, kind of being pulled in two directions by the so what direction. You know, take care of your life and the details of your life. You know, just that's what the path is all about. Just go forward. And then going up and indulging this wonderful breakfast with these wonderful people. So the end of the story, which I don't have to tell until the end, is that I actually had time in the end to do both. To have breakfast with them all and then still get my errands done before the meeting. But so I had breakfast with these people, and Mahagusananda was really a really exceptional person. I felt really inspired to be with him. And he's an old man, one of the few monks who survived the Pol Pot regime in Cambodia. And partly because, I think mostly because he was living in Thailand at the time. And he's very quiet. His name, Gosananda, I believe means something like joyful voice. But he hardly ever speaks. He's a very quiet person. But when he speaks, he usually has something very interesting and important to say. And I've heard some wonderful stories by him, and someday I'll tell you some stories about him. But so I was sitting next to him at breakfast, and he was talking about how in a few days he's going to go to England to meet with the royal family, because the royal family in England was going to donate all this money for tree planting in Cambodia, and he's interested in tree planting, he's involved in tree planting projects. So I asked him, here you are, the supreme patriarch of Cambodia, who's trying to reestablish Buddhism in Cambodia. It's a lot of work. Most of the Buddhism was completely eradicated and destroyed. All these new people are being ordained into the monkhood and need to be trained. Why are you interesting yourself with trees? You know, why trees instead of Buddhism? And he said, well, the Buddha spent most of his life under the trees. You know, he was born under a tree, he was enlightened under a tree, he taught under trees, he died under a tree. It's very important to have trees. And then Jack Kornfield piped up and he said, it's very important to have trees because then the tree spirits, the three devas, have a place to live. And so then Mahagusananda kind of squatted for a moment and he said, in India we have a saying that every leaf is a devata. Every leaf is a deva, is a god. He didn't say that a god lives in every leaf. He said every leaf is a god. It's a little bit different, isn't it? And so that was also a beautiful story. And then I went and did my errands. So I felt kind of blessed to go and have this little breakfast with these folks. And it's quite wonderful to be able to spend time with people who have practiced for, Mahagusananda has probably practiced for, I don't know, 50, 60 years. And he's a long, long time. And I was thinking about how there are cycles in a spiritual life. And sometimes in a cycle we spend a lot of time going off into spending time with other practitioners, with other teachers, with other sangha, being on retreat. And other times in our cycles of our spiritual life, we go off and we take care of our errands and go shopping and go to, you know, to the market and live in the world. And that much of our spiritual life, I think, can be seen as cycles. I think it's very important to see it in cycles so that we can recognize what's appropriate for us and not measure what's appropriate for us by some external idea or some what other people are doing. And there's something, I think it was Toynbee, the historian, who in his historical studies came to the conclusion that all major religious figures in history, I don't know if it's true or not, but it's what he said, go through cycles of withdrawal and return. Periods of time which they withdraw from the world or from normal life, go off into the desert or go off onto retreat or go into the woods or do something. And then cycles of returning and being in the world again. Cycles of withdrawal and return. And the Buddha, that's certainly true for the Buddha, who also went in cycles of, even after he was, you know, certainly before he was enlightened, he spent 6 years kind of on retreat. But even afterwards, and as you read the story of his life, he continued being actively involved in teaching at times, and then he would go into the woods and go on retreat and be very quiet, up to sometimes 3 months at a time, where he wouldn't see anybody and just do his own practice. And in our own tradition, in our Western lay Buddhist tradition, we have somewhat the same cycles in that most people don't do kind of big periods of the time where they go in cycles of withdrawal, but we have retreats that we do. And, you know, so the one-day retreats, the one-week retreats, the month-long retreats, three-month retreats we do are these periods of withdrawal that are very important for spiritual life. And then we come back into our regular life. In the same way, I think in our spirit, in our meditation life, there are also cycles, also changes over time, what's appropriate and how we practice. And there isn't kind of one set pathway to do mindfulness practice, that there are kind of variations depending on where you are in your cycles. And kind of most, maybe the most coarse way is when a person first begins doing mindfulness practice, they're sitting maybe cross-legged on the floor. Maybe kind of mostly what they're doing is cultivating a certain amount of patience so they can deal with the aches and the pains of the dealing with the posture. And then with time, the aches and the pains in the body kind of maybe pass away, and more subtle phenomena becomes what you deal with, what you work with, and patience with your physical body is not really the important thing. As our meditation begins settling down, at a certain point of settleness, we talk about what's called the seven factors of awakening. And I've talked about them some here, but the seven factors of awakening are factors of mind or factors of the heart or of meditation that come into play when our mind is somewhat stable. And these seven factors of awakening can be understood in different ways, but one way is that they refer to cycles that we go through. And there's times when certain aspects of these seven factors are stressed, are important to deal with and understand. And then there are cycles and periods of when other ones are important. And there are three, these seven factors can be divided into three categories, three kinds of factors. The first is usually called the energizing factors. That's what kind of enliven or energize the practice in our mind or heart, the vitalizing. And then the other category is that which is calming or tranquilizing. And these two are sometimes, are usually paired, and they need to have a kind of healthy balance between the two. And then the third category, kind of sitting over them as an umbrella, is mindfulness, the factor of mindfulness. And it said mindfulness itself, the factor of mindfulness, of paying attention, you don't really go through cycles of that. That's always appropriate no matter where you are, in whatever spiritual cycle you're at, just to pay attention. But sometimes what's involved in our practice is cycles of becoming calmer, more settled, or more tranquil. That's mostly what we need. And I think it's true for a lot of people when they first start meditating, that mostly what they're doing is settling the mind down so that the mind can become pliable or workable, is a technical word for it, so they can kind of use the mind to pay attention. So rather than being usually the monkey mind we have, our mind is using us. And when the mind gets settled enough to a certain point, we can start using the mind, or we can start using our attention in some kind of useful way. So we talk about the mind being workable or pliable. So there are periods when mostly we need to calm down or be settled. And I think, I know in my own life there are times when I get really frazzled. And it's just mostly what I need just to calm down. And then the other end of the balance is those factors which are energizing, which pick us up, which vitalize our practice. When a practice becomes complacent or stagnant, these other factors become very important. And there are cycles in life when those aspects become predominant in a person's practice. So it's very important to kind of, at some point, maybe not if you're a new practitioner, but at some point, to get some sense of what these are so you know what you need to be working on. And the one that I want to talk about today, the one energizing factor I want to talk about today is the factor of investigation, the inquiring mind, as has been coined by a newspaper. And the factor of investigation is very closely, maybe of all the different factors of awakening, is the one that's most closely related to mindfulness. They kind of overlap quite a bit. They're very closely related. In meditation, in practice or life, I think many people distinguish between doing and being. And when people do this, they often value being more than doing. And doing is kind of rushing around the monkey mind, trying to do a lot of things, doing all the errands or whatever. And doing is just not trying to be anything, not trying to become anything, just being ourselves and kind of resting in the present in some kind of way. And so in meditation, that works fairly well, because meditation isn't so much doing as it is being, just allowing yourself to be, and in allowing yourself to be, kind of settling. However, in mindfulness meditation, there's a further distinction where there's a distinction between being and knowing. And it isn't just simply favoring being over doing, but in some sense we favor knowing over being. That there's another thing that can happen. If you just be, allow yourself to be, there's a tendency at some point, and maybe not initially, but at some point in people's practice that they become complacent and they become too calm or become sleepy. Being by itself can kind of drain you of energy. And there's this wonderful kind of natural quality of mind or quality of heart, which is called investigation, or called knowing or investigation or wisdom. And the knowing factor, the investigating factor, is what kind of can propel one's practice beyond levels of complacency, beyond plateaus or stagnant places that we can come in our practice. In my own practice, when I came back from Asia, from practicing for a long time, the mindfulness practice there, I kind of mixed up my Zen practice and my mindfulness practice for a while, because I went back to live at a Zen center. And when I did my Zen practice, for me it was primarily just a being practice. And it worked very well for me, and I'd just be there, sit there in the meditation hall, just be. And I would settle, and the mind would settle, the heart would settle, and become very spacious and sometimes very clear, and just allowing myself to be and not adding anything to my mind, trying to do anything with myself, just kind of accepting myself as I was. But at some point, I'd feel like I get to a plateau. And it was just kind of long plateau, kind of flat plateau. Initially, at the beginning of the period of being in the plateau, it was like a relief. But if you're calm for a long period of time, after a while, the calm loses its wonderful relief quality. And it becomes kind of old and kind of dull. And people either stop practicing or start falling asleep. And I spent a lot of time in my Zen practice sound asleep in meditation. Partly because in Zen practice, I wasn't taught to investigate so well. I wasn't taught the knowing factor, the energizing factors weren't taught to me so much. I was mostly practicing being and acceptance. So when I came back from Asia, first I'd do this being practice of just allowing myself to be until I felt I'd gotten on this plateau and I wasn't settling anymore. And then I would add, what I'd do is I'd gently add the factor of knowing, an investigation. And the knowing and the investigation is kind of, what is actually going on here? Now that I'm a little bit calm, I look around. What's actually happening in this state? What's happening with my mind, with my reactions, my thoughts, my heart, in my body, in my mental state, in my mood. Investigating and finding out what's actually happening. It's asking the question, what's going on here? When I was sitting with Upandita in Burma, I kind of sat a little bit the same way, in that the first 10 or 15 minutes of each sitting, I would just kind of allow myself just to be, not to try to do anything at all. And then once I settled, I'd start doing the mindfulness practice. But when he got wind that I was practicing this way, he was a little bit upset with me. And he started asking me every time I went for an interview, I want to talk about the deeper experiences I was having in meditation. And he would kind of cut me off and say, "What were you experiencing at the beginning of your sittings?" Well, I wasn't paying that kind of attention. And he said, "Well," he sent me out. And if you couldn't answer, he'd send you away. So the next day I'd come back and he'd say, "What did you experience at the beginning of your sittings? What were they like?" Okay, go back and try again. So because Upendita wanted you to pay attention all the time. For him, there was no other practice than mindfulness practice, than paying attention. And you didn't wait to pay attention. You started paying attention where you were. And not only that, you weren't even supposed to wait until you were sitting on your cushion. Because then at some point you go in and he asked you, you're ready to tell him all about your meditation experience. And he kind of leaned forward and say, "What were you aware of when you were brushing your teeth this morning? Or what were you aware of when you walked in through the door to this room for the interview? You know, usually you're so nervous you don't even know." So he sends you away. And if you don't know, you have to go back. And so he wanted you to pay attention all the time, because there was no beginning or end of practice, mindfulness practice. If I feel very kind of frazzled or something, I still occasionally will sit in meditation to unwind and just to be, to de-stress or calm down. But I find myself doing this less and less with time. And one of the reasons is that I feel that inquiring into what is happening, seeing clearly into what's happening, is more deeply satisfying to my sense of inner integrity than becoming calm. That even though I might feel frazzled or angry or upset, if I spend time investigating or studying and being present with that in a careful way, that's has more integrity, it's more truth to it than it is kind of calming out and kind of getting below that stuff. So I do less and less the calming. But still, we go through cycles, and we have, there are periods of time when the more calming, soothing parts of practice are important to cultivate, and parts when the energizing are more important to cultivate. So you're sitting here in this wonderful meditation hall, and you're sitting very quiet and you're very peaceful after about 20 minutes, or I don't know how long it takes for you. Or you're trying to be, and so you're kind of attached to some idea what you're trying to do. And the door opens up, someone stumbles in loudly late, or someone sneezes. And so you get irritated or annoyed. So there's various options of what to do. One option is to just notice your irritation and then focus even more strongly on the breath to calm down quickly. Another option is to do nothing and allow yourself to get carried off into your annoying, irritating thoughts about why are they coming late, and why doesn't Gil kind of say anything, or why doesn't, the person, not sneeze, or why, or how could they, or, and assume that you're off on a trip for 5 minutes, commenting on it. And maybe there's a quieter meditation center somewhere, there must be. probably go to the Zen people, And you're kind of lost. You've kind of been pulled into one of these black holes of the mind where you don't even know what you're thinking. And the other option you have is to inquire into what's actually happening. To inquire what's happening now that you're annoyed. What happens that you're irritated? What's going on in your mind? What's being triggered? What's your feelings? What's it like in the body? And to investigate that. Because really, the door opening up, there's nothing irritating about a door opening up. What really disturbs our practice is not the door, but is our annoyance. So it's misplaced criticism to blame the door. If you really, what you should look at carefully is our sense of annoyance, our condemning, our complaining, what's going on within us. I think that's much more useful, especially in this kind of context. So this is the importance of inquiry, to find out what you're responsible for. And I think it's fairly rare that we do that. More often than not, we kind of wander off in the narrative, or the condemning, the stories we create around it. So in mindfulness practice, investigation is very important, the inquiring mind. And it can be said, should be said over and over again, that this form of investigation is, especially in meditation practice, is not thinking about what's happening, or contemplating, or analyzing what's happening. It's bringing the light of awareness, shining the light of awareness on what our experience is, so we can sense and feel and experience it much more carefully and finely. Some people who are, when they hear a talk on investigation, the importance of investigation in mindfulness practice, some people are surprised, some people are upset, some people are shy away from it, because it sounds like you're making your mind busy, you're doing something with your mind again. And what they think meditation is about is becoming calm or quiet with the mind, stopping the busy chatter, so that the mind, you know, you don't want to add more activity of the mind to kind of make it more agitated or more coarser or something. So I think investigation kind of makes it coarser, is more, is doing more. But the kind of investigation that really happens in as a factor of awakening needs a silent mind to work. The mind has to become quiet. It's kind of a silent presence with what's happening. Today I was up on a hiking trail, and in the last few weeks the hazelnut bushes are just coming into bud. And it's just really exquisite, just little buds kind of coming out. And in order to see the exquisiteness, to see the hazelnut buds coming out, you have to be kind of present. You have to be, no, you have to be kind of silent. You have to be kind of quietly present. If you're busy and talking a lot and kind of lost in your train of thoughts or whatever, you can't really see because it's so subtle right now, the level at which the buds are coming out. But if you're silent and quiet and present enough, you can see the detail of these little buds. You can see the distinctions. So part of the investigation is a quiet, silent, clear enough mind that can see distinctions, clear distinctions of actually what's going on. We talk a lot in Buddhism, and I don't talk, we don't talk, but sometimes about discriminating wisdom, the discriminating mind, which is another kind of word for mindfulness or investigation, is a mind that can see clearly and make distinctions between, between the different kinds of emotions we have, the different feelings in the body, the different textures, the qualities, the sensations, to distinguish between how we're thinking about something and what's actually happening, what the relationship is we have with something and what is actually happening. All these things require, I think, are very much helped by kind of bringing kind of a still, quiet, investigative, inquiring mind into our experience. One way to have the inquiring mind or the investigating mind in this practice is to ask the question, hold up a question in the mind or in the body. What is going on now? What is this? Just have the question and not expect an answer. Then don't try for an answer. Just it's enough to hold the question. And it's almost as if you have the question, hold the question, it's like you're predisposing or you're kind of setting a certain attitude in place that opens up the experience in a new way, kind of allows you to probe or penetrate in a quiet way more deeply into what's actually going on. And maybe the simplest question or attitude is, what is this? What's going on? But there are all kinds of interesting questions you can ask yourself to kind of help kind of the mindfulness kind of really be clearly present for the experience. One that I think is often useful is to ask yourself, what am I avoiding now? Just what's being avoided now? And again, you don't have to expect an answer, but simply opening up that question opens a kind of sense in the body and the mind that maybe some answer will come out by itself. Or another kind of variation I like is, what needs to be accepted right now? Again, just what needs to be accepted by the mindfulness, by presence. Or you can ask any kind of question you want. It's very useful to find a personal question that represents the motivation you have for spiritual practice. All of us have some kind of motivation. And at times, again, I'm talking about cycles, so there's no shoulds here. Recently I read a book that talked about coulding rather than shoulding. Right? That certain things are coulds rather than shoulds. So investigation is a could. that's appropriate sometimes. But you can ask yourself sometimes, what's motivates you in your practice? And then you can ask some kind of question that kind of crystallizes that. And you just hold the question as part of your presence. Well, one person some time ago told me she was eager to go back onto a longer retreat because she wanted to discover where her thoughts came from. I thought that was really beautiful. She was really inspired. She had gone on retreat and kind of discovered this miracle of thoughts and how they kind of seem to arise, where they arise from. And she wasn't interested in the content of her thought, the story, but what was behind them? Where do they come from? Where do they arise out of? So she had this great kind of inquiring zeal or curiosity. And there are times when the bigger questions are what really motivates or vitalizes our practice. Such questions as, you know, what is life? Who am I? What is death? What is a breath? What is a thought? What is the body? So in our cycles of life, there are times when there are big kind of existential questions that are asked, and times when very minute kind of inquiring goes into the details of our breath, the details of the inhalation, the details of the beginning of the inhalation. What is the first hint of the inhalation you feel when you meditate? What's the last experience of exhalation? To hold that question, what's actually happening? I was thinking about this today. I thought about how in some ways once human beings are capable of language, maybe earlier, I don't know, but at some point, our life is framed often by questioning, kind of naturally. I think, I don't know why children do it, but often young children, maybe at the age of 2, I don't know when is it? They start asking, you know, why and what all the time? What is it and why is it over and over again? Asking this wonder. Sometimes it's wonderful delight. I don't know why they do it. But they ask all these questions. And I think sometimes it's kind of that kind of curiosity, that kind of desire to know is actually a beautiful natural part of the mind. If you let yourself, allow yourself to be thoroughly enough, not do anything, you'll find yourself being curious, I think, many times. So on one end of life, we have the questioning children. The other end of life, it seems that a lot of people, as they die, question their life. They kind of review their life and ask kind of questions about what is the unfinished business of the life, what needs to be done, what was our life about. Many people, apparently, when they die, will ask questions like, what was the meaning of my life? What did I accomplish? What's the end of this story? Who did I connect with? Jack Kornfield's a wonderful question. Did I love well? Some people ask that at the end. Did I connect fully with people? Did I love people well? Did I meet my spouse fully? Or not? You know, can I do it now? I think sometimes it seems to be at the end of life, people ask questions also. And I think that one way of really bringing depth to our life in the in-between periods, between the being children and being dying, is to do the same thing that brings life and vitality to either side, either end of life, is to question deeply, to ask and probe. And what is our life? Am I loving really well? Am I connected really well? What is it to be alive? What is it to be human? What is it to be aware? What is it to breathe? And then I was struck that the words in English, questioning and quest, have the same Latin root. And the Latin root means to seek. And in my kind of teaching, from those of you who've been around long enough, you know that seeking kind of has a bad rap. But, you know, we should respect everything, all words, I think, all concepts. So seeking, so questioning. And in a sense, I think human beings will always be questing. We should always be questing. It's always the endless quest that we're on. And the kind of seeking that I kind of feel comfortable about talking about is a kind of seeking which seeks, which is opening up to the possibilities inherent in our existence, opening up to the possibilities inherent in the present moment. It's opening up and maintaining that openness. So it's not seeking for something, some goal or idea or something, but rather seeking for an ability to be present for infinite number of possibilities. Because as the present arrives, it all comes with infinite future possibilities. So to be present, that kind of seeking to be open, to be present, kind of seeking for not seeking, maybe, I don't know. It's an investigation. Sometimes we say that it's looking, not looking for something, but it's learning to look at something carefully. Not looking, not having any expectations or desire what will happen when we investigate. Many mindfulness students, I think all of you probably will find it, either done this or will soon enough, will be motivated to investigate more carefully at what's happening because you want something. You want the investigation to get rid of something, or you want the investigation to kind of make you cope better with something, or you have some expectation. Investigation can be done just simply with just simply looking at, not looking for something or expecting anything. And the questioning is very important, I think. The idea that our life is always a quest, because it seems that for the most part, maybe except maybe for a Buddha, that there's a tendency for the mind to get stuck. Life is an open system full of endless possibilities, and we tend to get stuck in our attachments, our idea of how things should be, how we should be, in our opinions and our beliefs. I read today that beliefs are the hardening of the mental arteries. And mindfulness is the... What's mindfulness? Mindfulness is the... What?
HDL.
I have a plumbing image. What's the name of the Roto-Rooter? So one of the places where I investigate, which is very important for me, is to investigate when I feel stuck, or when I feel kind of preoccupied by something, or I feel certain clinging or attachment. There are various times. So like when I left this steering committee meeting we had on Saturday, I didn't exactly feel stuck, but I was kind of stuck. I kind of was preoccupied. Kind of something really wasn't quite sitting right for me. So I spent the rest of the afternoon kind of investigating, reflecting. Why was my mind stuck? Why was my kind of this stuckness feeling? That's where investigation became very important for me. And you can feel sometimes when there's clinging. The tangible quality was like the cling. And you investigate that, discover, look into that, what's going on. It would have been easy for me to go on for a run or kind of wiped it out, because running is one way you kind of loosen things up in the arteries so they kind of float around for a while. But then, I mean, after a while, they settle down again and become stuck. So running, doing all kinds of things, I think investigation is really the most powerful way. So to ask, to discover what's going on, to question. So all of you should be aware of this. As your practice continues, there are times when what's appropriate is investigating, is asking what's going on, to look more carefully. And then it occurred to me, this is kind of slightly maybe a non sequitur, but I'll end with this. A great place to explore practice investigation is when you go to the movies. And what I suggest is you go to a good movie that's really gripping and really involves you, and go to it and enjoy it. And then rather than leaving the theater, stay and watch it again. And then pay attention. Pay attention to what's going on, because so much of what happens, not only in movies but in life, is we create a reality. And movies, that's even more so. All it is a flat screen. And if you watch the movie again, you start paying attention to, and then they have, what the mind does and what it actually is you're looking at, rather than you're caught in the story. And if you do that, if you go to see the movie immediately right away, you have the contrast between the way you were involved first time and the way you were involved the second time. And I think you'll discover something. You might get bored, but it's actually maybe more fascinating. It's actually more of a drama that you'll discover, because you discover the drama, the intrigue, the mystery, the horror of your own mind. The joy, the humor. Yeah, we have to laugh a lot. So maybe we can end with about a minute or two of sitting.